Hello, and welcome to Need to Know, your weekly investment podcast brought to you by the experts at Coutts. I'm Sarah Muir, and I'm joined as always by Coutts CIO, Alan Higgins. Each week on the podcast, we look at the three things investors need to know. That might be for the week ahead, but it's also we look at longer term trends, and we do some of the reading of perhaps some of the drier research so that you don't have to. Before we get to that, though, Alan, I suppose we should, because we've got a kind of big overarching theme for today's call, but we probably should just touch on last week. We did talk on last week's podcast about the Bank of England meeting, the Fed meeting, and also Bank of Japan, which you said was the one you were going to be watching. So thoughts on, well, perhaps let's start with the Fed, because that was, I don't want to say boring, but it was very well signposted, wasn't it?
You've got it exactly right. Yeah, morning, Sarah. Fed, super easy. They did exactly as they said they would, as expected. No change in rates. Somewhat hawkish commentary. Hawkish means pushing for maybe marginally higher rates. But yeah, exactly as expected.
Yeah. And then, of course, the Bank of England, which was the one that was perhaps harder to predict. It really went to the wire, didn't it?
It did. It was a 5-4 vote. So it did go to the wire. 5-4 vote for no change, as everyone knows. We don't like to be too backward looking here, but that's why we're covering it kind of in the preamble. But of course, what made it 5-4 was probably that remarkably good inflation number out of the UK.
Yes. Yes.
Which, you know, it's taken ages. And the crucial number was core. Core fell from 6.8 to 6.2. It's still a lot higher than the number in the US.
Yeah.
But it's in line with Germany. So do you know who the outlier is now?
Well, I'm guessing, I don't know whether this is still the case, but I'm guessing Sweden.
Yeah, the start of the Beyonce concert.
Is Beyonce still on tour in Sweden? What's going on
there? No, but in case you haven't listened to us before, I think it was Danske Bank who officially blamed higher inflation in Sweden on the hype over Beyonce starting a concert there and higher restaurant prices, higher hotel prices. Talking to my experts in Sweden, they continue to point to the weakness of the currency as the main reason for higher inflation. But Sweden's up at 7.7, so a real outlier. So look, it's only one number for the UK, but UK now looks more like in line with the rest of Europe.
Okay, and we've got a bit more. I mean, what's the next sort of bit of UK data we've got coming out that will kind of perhaps cement this sort of slightly more positive narrative? What are we waiting for?
So this is the positive side has been this recent inflation number. The more negative side has been wages. Wages have been stubbornly high. So there'll be a close look at that for some confirmation. And of course, it's just one inflation number. Can it be a blip? You know, so next month will be a big one for the UK. I think it's fair to say good wages numbers and a second month of very, very, very good inflation or good inflation, that may be enough to tip the balance and say we're done. We shall see.
It's interesting. Before we get on to the sort of main topic of today, I was reading, because there's been some criticism about how well the Bank of England have predicted the trajectory for inflation. And I did read that Ben Bernanke is looking at how the Bank of England actually produces inflation and where produces their forecasts. And I mean, could we see the Bank of England with a dot plot like we see with the Fed?
Yeah, it's something that they could look at. I mean, you do get officials, the likes of Hugh Pill and others, comment in the media on their thoughts. So that does come out. But in the US, they do it on a more formal basis. So yeah, that could be one way of looking at it. To be fair, all central banks missed this rise in inflation. And so it's not just the UK. So, but still, look, useful. And, you know, I really hope they look at monetary aggregates, which we talked about before, excessive money supply, and they look at the period of ultra low rates and saying, really, did we have to keep rates so low for so long? But that's, you know, my view. Let's see.
Okay. All right, then. Well, let's move on to our main topic for today, which we have split into three sections because we have to have three things we look at in Need to Know. And it's prompted by we're revisiting Michael Burry's Big Short, aren't we? So what are we looking at today?
Yeah, the last time, because again, for newer listeners, because it did cause some concern with some of our clients, Michael Burry, aka Christian Bale from The Big Short, a 1.6 billion put option position disclosed. Sounds very large, but as we've mentioned before, it can be quite a small position when you buy these put options, these bearish positions out of the money. But still, and therefore we look back at some, we've looked back at two crashes so far, 87, 2000 to 2003. And we won't cover the COVID, the more recent COVID healthcare crisis, pandemic crisis, because that's, I mean, pretty well known. But I think we'll cover 08, 09, which, of course, Michael Burry did see coming. And yes, I'll have to put my hand up. I did not see 08, 09 coming, and I'll say why. I did see 2000 to 2003 coming, but then again, so did a lot of people. Very few people saw 08, 09 coming.
So, well, I guess before we, I want to ask you why so few people saw it, because I'm going to echo something that the Queen asked about this. But before we get to that, what caused it then? For those that perhaps have forgotten about it or didn't understand it at the time, because it was quite complex, wasn't it?
It was. So we'll break it down into three. We'll have a look at subprime mortgages and mortgages in general. Yeah. I want to talk about, less talked about, how it was a devastating period for hedge funds, largely. Yes. Yeah. And how that, the knock-on effects of that.
Because they did well in the last crash, didn't they?
That's right.
That was, you mentioned last week.
They did superbly well in the 2000 to 2003 crash. And then really the meat of it is, okay, the warning signs, that there weren't many, but you know what we can detect in that period, 08, 09, and some of the troubles, is there any evidence of that today?
Yeah, I guess it's what we're asking is, has Michael Burry seen something in today's market that maybe mirrors what he was seeing? Perhaps not exactly the same, but something similar that he saw back in 2000. Well, when did he see it? 2005, 2006, he's first spotted it?
Probably 06, 07, something like that. Mm. He was early. You know, we pay homage to him and the others because there weren't many who saw it.
Yeah, okay. All right, then. Well, let's talk about then, first of all, then, well, explain what caused the subprime mortgage crisis, which then...
Well, firstly, starting on subprime mortgages, I'll ask you, because I've asked others. And an interesting reaction, do you think subprime mortgages are a good or a bad thing?
I guess it depends, but my feeling is if you are an individual, you are entitled to have a secure home. Now, you might not be earning enough money to perhaps to have a mortgage with very favourable terms. But I think anybody's entitled to have secure housing. And if that means owning your own house, then I think that's fair enough. But I'm looking at it perhaps more from a humanistic point of view than from a purely financial point of view.
I'm glad you looked at it from that point of view, Sarah, because often when I mention that, I mention that to the Coutts grads, for example, and their perspective, oh, no, it sounds terrible, because the name does sound terrible. Well, I was lucky enough to meet the founder, or at least one of the founders of subprime mortgages. Very interesting individual. And it's quite illuminating, the story he told. I tried to be brief, but I think it does bring it alive. So he was a regular mortgage broker in California. And he started to get inquiries from people who couldn't get mortgages. People like, this is how he described it, Mexican immigrants, people just come out of prison, people who've previously defaulted. And they were willing to pay the higher rates. And he just thought about it. He thought, well, but the whole of the banking sector was completely avoiding this sector. He thought, well, you know, provided I can charge a higher rate, provided I value the property properly and they put some cash down, then, you know, maybe it's a good thing. So he started basically doing this. But he had a couple of principles. One, he wanted a relatively high deposit, 10 to 25% minimum. So that secondly, he charged a higher interest rate. He's in business because there are defaults because they are riskier. And thirdly, crucially, he valued, if he didn't value the properties himself, he had someone very reliable value the property. So there's nothing false in them. And he told the story and he said he quickly ran out of money. They quickly became successful running out of money. And he tried to securitize, which we're going to come on to, which is basically give the loans to Wall Street and basically free up capital so he could do some more.
Yeah.
And he said to me, he went to see all the top banks and they said, no, we're not getting involved with, and they used quite offensive words like lending money to people of that character. I won't use the words he said. And he said, well, okay, fine, but I seem to be making, you know, good money out of it. And then he told one lovely story, which he said there was one time, you know, I thought my life was in danger. He said, I had this large Mexican family who were behind on their loan. So I basically called them and wrote to them and I said, look, I'm really sorry, but if you don't pay your $240 monthly payment by next week, I'm going to have to repossess the property. That's, you know, obviously how it works.
Yeah.
So he worked on Saturday then. He said, I remember it so clearly. He said, and all of a sudden, Saturday morning, 10 a.m., something like that, who comes from the door is the huge Mexican guy comes in. Then his four just as huge sons, okay, and a few daughters, then the grandmother, okay, then the little child. And I thought, oh God, they're here to kill me. They're all here to kill me and witness it. And I'll hide his name. And they said, I'll use a Welsh name. They said, Mr. Jones, please, please, we really want to keep our house. And they said, one by one, they emptied their pockets. The main guy put down $150. And then even the little children put $5 and they said, here's $240. Please, can we keep our house? So, and of course he did. And I thought it's a nice story. And you can see exactly what you said. There was a real, you know, nice purpose to it as well as making money. Anyway, he goes on to say they ruined it, Wall Street, because after, you know, dismissing him, they finally realized his little corner and a few others were making huge money, charging interest rates 10 to 12%. And defaults are relatively limited because people want to keep their own houses.
Yeah.
So then,
and also property prices were going up consistently, weren't they? So
exactly.
Even if somebody defaulted, you've got, I own the house and the value of that property is going to go up anyway, so I can't lose.
So then Wall Street ruined it, as he puts it. And, you know, the rest is history. But the way Wall Street ruined it is kind of how it's a big part. And I guess we should say we're covering the 08-09 financial crisis more from a US perspective.
Yeah.
We'll have to come back another time to cover UK and the rest of the world, of course. But from a US perspective, because, you know, Michael Burry's put options are on the US market as disclosed. And so this is how it works. You basically get $100 million worth of subprime mortgages, give them to Wall Street, and Wall Street says, okay, 70% of these, I'm going to say, are going to be AAA. They're going to be good.
Yeah.
And the way of thinking about that is that there are going to be defaults, but surely they're not going to be more than 30%. They're safe. And then much lower rated stuff. I'm trying to do a version of this of like Margot Robbie did in the bar in the Big Short film. I'm not sure. I'm sure she's better than me, but I'll give it a go.
She had a script, to be fair.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. As usual, I don't have a script. I'm trying to do it all in my head as we speak. So 70%. AAA, 30% down to double B, just a bit of, and triple B's just to simplify. Now that structure, although it was abused, that survived, that basic structure. So most people think that was the problem. That wasn't the problem.
Okay.
Because defaults on those AAAs were almost zero.
Yeah, which you would expect. That's why they're rated AAA.
That's why they're rated AAA on the first level. So rating agencies, investors did a fair job. Now, of course, were there defaults on triple Bs and double Bs? Losses. There were, yeah. But then again, you knew what you were getting into in triple Bs and double Bs. So this is where the Margot Robbie bit comes in. What was the problem was Wall Street taking it to the next level. They said, let's take all these triple Bs and do another securitization.
Okay.
So these triple Bs that are quite likely to default, especially in a bad property market.
Yeah.
Okay. They put them all together and they went to the rating agencies and said, you know what? Surely with all these triple Bs, surely we can have, you know, 30 or 40% triple A's. And the rating agency said, yeah, you know, that seems reasonable. Mm. And that was the problem because, and then you have a behavioral thing. If I say to you, Sarah, oh, this is triple A, maybe you won't do your research. You know, so
I'm going to trust you and I'm going to trust the rating agencies that they've done their due diligence on my behalf.
Yeah. Okay. And look, they will say it's an opinion. Okay. It's fair. I think investors have to. I was shown some of this stuff. And as I say, I'm putting my hand up. I didn't see 08, 09 coming at all, but I was showing some of this stuff as an investor. in 07. And I definitively said no. I said, you know, wait, you know, not because I saw it coming, just because I had way too complex, way too convoluted. Mm. The basic securitization I can take. So, I mean, that was the basis of it, and a poor US housing market. But kind of related to that, before we move on, because you've lived in Germany for a long while.
And I did.
You know, intrigued, why could this never happen in Germany, apart from the German characteristics? And tell us a bit about the German property market, because I know a bit, but it's,
yeah,
I don't get it, why, it, how it works.
It's very different. I mean, obviously, I haven't lived there for about 6 years, but it's certainly home owning is seen as much less of an investment opportunity than perhaps it's seen in the UK. And I did check to see what the sort of latest figures are. And something like 46% of Germans are homeowners, which means that the majority still rent. And actually, in Germany, it is still reasonably, you know, a tenant has a pretty good protected status. You can't be, unless you break the terms of your agreement, you can't be evicted by your landlord. There's actually quite long notice periods the longer you've lived in the property. And it's not unusual to live in a rented property for more than 8 years, in which case your landlord has got to give you 9 months notice. And even then, they can only move you out because they want to use the property for themselves. So they can say, right, I now want to live in this house that I'm renting to you. So I'm going to give you notice and then I'm going to move into the house. And even if the house is sold, I believe it's still the case. If anyone's listening, does know more about the German housing market than I do, which is quite possible, do let me know. Just because the house is sold, that doesn't terminate your rental agreement as a tenant. So the tenant has got, it's much more comfortable being a tenant. You're much more protected in Germany, or it certainly used to be the case. I'm not sure about things like sort of rental and things. I think this is something we need to probably explore a lot more, because I think we can look at the variations between different countries. But certainly, home ownership in Germany is much less prevalent than it is in other countries. And it's certainly not seen as, I'm buying a house as an investment because I'm going to sell it for more money and I'm going to make my way up the property ladder. There isn't that mentality, or very few people. That's not to say that people don't buy properties as an investment as a landlord, but you don't see homeowners buying their family home and seeing it as a potential investment.
Yeah, I think we should cover that. We've got a senior German colleague, and it may be worth getting him on, because I think I'm interested in this and also the general risk aversion when it comes to equity. So I think we can have a bit of a German theme there. So it is different country by country. And by the way, 08, 09 was not just about subprime, but subprime was a big part of it. And this AAA stuff, a lot of banks in Germany, bringing it back to Germany, bought it.
Yes.
A lot of insurance companies like AIG, which got in trouble, also bought it. And the key is they bought it in too big a size because it was AAA.
But well, it was highly leveraged as well, wasn't it? That was the other issue.
Well, that's the double securitization, if you like, which is the issue. But it wasn't just that. I mean, Lehman Brothers got into trouble for a bit of that, but also straightforward commercial property. Owning commercial property on a leverage basis, which is less well understood. But 08-09, you know, stock market ended up down 55%. You know, it was a very, very big one. But do you know what? The day that Lehman Brothers went under, the level of the S&P 500 was 1,200. Okay, today we're 4,500. So it just puts things in perspective. Now, by the way, if you entered at 1,200, it was horrible, because the markets continued to crash all the way down. And so another 40%, in fact. So it's very, very horrible. But longer term, the truth is out. Investing in stocks on a diversified basis, as we know, I'm a big advocate for stocks for the long run.
Yeah.
1,200 versus 4,500. If you put your money in when Lehman's went under, and then never looked for it at your account until now, you would be happy.
Yeah. On the subject of the stock market, you've talked previously about how you often had a bubble before a crash. What was happening in markets prior to the subprime mortgage crisis? Was there any kind of concept, sense of a bubble or a sort of exuberance in markets?
No, not at all. And I don't mind linking in. This is almost my third bit on differences in comparison, but we can make it make it more of a kind of free discussion, because as I mentioned, 87 and 2000 to 2003 both had one rising bond yields fairly sharply, very sharply in 87 and somewhat sharply in 1999-2000, and a huge bubble in stocks. Remember the 5 years, I mean, I'm sure you'll remember this, in, up into 2000, 5 years, the NASDAQ, 820%, okay?
Yeah.
And that's why I saw it coming, in inverted in inverted commas, because it was ridiculous speculation. I was far too early, like a lot of people. In contrast, this time, you know, bond yields really didn't do that much. They fell, if anything, from 5.25 to 4.25, not doing it much. And the multiple on the S&P 500 was 14 times earnings.
Which is perfectly respectable.
Yeah, it's cheaper than now. Yeah. It was 30 times earnings for 2000 and 20 times earnings in 87. So, yeah, it was, dare I say, tricky to forecast. Well, and I'm sorry I missed it. Unless you're Michael Burry, a genius like Michael Burry.
Well, exactly. Because wasn't it the case when our late Queen visited the London School of Economics in, I think, 2009, and I've got a quote here, she was talking to the various sort of very highly intelligent people at the London School of Economics and said, how come nobody could foresee it?
Yeah. I think that's
the
a very
smart
good
people
point.
In the room didn't see it coming.
Yeah, I think it's a fair point. And I'll put myself in that category as somewhat smart, but not as smart as all the people at LSE. But And I think that's partly the point. It was so dramatic because only a few saw it coming. And you get that flavour from the film, don't you?
Yeah,
that
definitely.
That relatively few saw it coming. And to be fair, I worked with at the time, I was at Morgan Stanley at the time, and Morgan Stanley itself was, you know, considered at risk. I worked with some tremendous macro investors who look at that, and they did see it to a certain extent and did see the housing market seep through. I guess if I put my hand up, I mean, I always saw the subprime mortgage market as small, because it was small.
Yeah.
But there was derivatives on derivatives, what we haven't gone into, as well as the double securitization. There was derivatives based on the double securitization, which made it larger than kind of most people saw. So look, but also some of the smartest hedge funds, going into our second topic, some of the smartest hedge funds in the world didn't see it coming.
Well, yeah, because you mentioned last week, you talked about how well hedge funds did during the, what I call the dot-com bubble. But actually, conversely, they did, a lot of them did very badly during the global financial crisis.
Yeah, so 2000 to 2003, classic fund of funds, hedge funds. So think of basically owning 20 hedge funds inside a fund. Before stock market again was down 50%. You're talking about returns overall of about 10% over those 2 or 3 years. So really solid returns, both at the old Coutts hedge funds, fund of funds, which we sold to Aberdeen, and also elsewhere. So it was basically pretty solid performance of fund of funds in that period, because so-called market neutral strategies, and I'm going to pick on convertible arbitrage, which is quite market neutral, worked beautifully well during that period. 08-09, a little bit different.
Okay. What happened? What went wrong?
Well, if I convertible arbitrage fell 40% on average as a strategy, which is almost as much as the stock market. And it became a huge credit risk that people didn't see. The idea that the credit sold off so much, and kind of linking into differences. Okay, where people smartly did see warning signs is high yield bonds in general. So we just talked about subprime kind of high yield or near high yield debt, but in general, corporate high yield did give a warning sign. If I do round numbers, the additional yield you could get on high yield at its lows were about 2%.
Yeah.
And it got to about 6%. This is before stocks sold off. So a lot of people, because of that, really do look at a high yield. And do you know where it went to? So it went from 2 to 6 prior to the crisis.
Okay.
Again, round numbers, it went to 20%. You got an extra 20% for investing in high yield. So if you own these things, and a lot of convertible bonds were high yield,
Yeah.
You got absolutely destroyed. If I put in simple terms, convertible bonds that weren't meant to fall that much because of credit reasons fell 50 or 60 points. Selling for equity reasons is fine.
Yeah.
Because convertible arbitrage, because it's called arbitrage, we're hedging out the equity. Mm. Now, again, kind of coming to the mixing in the third point today.
Yeah.
Good news is we're not at six. We never got as low as two. We've gone from about 3 to 4 in round numbers.
Mm.
So it's really not warning the same. 2 to 6 is pretty dramatic. 3 to 4, that's, you know, in my mind, noise. But yeah, hedge funds got absolutely decimated. So the average fund of funds was down about 20%. It depends. Okay, that's better than stock markets. But crucially, Sarah, it's not what investors were expecting.
Yes.
After the period 2000 to 2003. And that's what really, really hurt it. And even some amazing names today that still survive today, Citadel. Mm. You heard of Citadel?
I have heard of Citadel. Yeah, you've mentioned Citadel before.
I think we'll talk a bit about them because they do a lot of the trading for the likes of Robinhood. When we review Dumb Money, which is out now, I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, is it? All right, okay.
Yeah, one of my colleagues said, look, a podcast has already done a review on Dumb Money.
Do you know who you are?
Yeah, I said, sorry, I'm behind the times. I need to get to the cinema. But we will review it. But Citadel, absolute powerhouse, run by Ken Griffin. Superb performance over 20, 30 years performance. Superb. And, you know, this is a real genius. But even with a genius like that, their fund at one stage was down 40 to 50%, according to documents I've seen. But he's completely recovered from it.
Okay.
Completely recovered it. And convertible arbitrage was a big part of his strategy, allegedly. I mean, a lot of these hedge funds, you don't know exactly what went on. But look, I'm not picking on that because I'm going to say, just in case an employee, this is one of the best hedge funds in the world that people would die to have access to.
Yeah.
But even amazing managers like that got caught out in 08 and 09. There was one category of hedge funds that performed really well, which is an interesting hedge, so-called CTAs.
Okay.
Commodity Trader Advisors, managed futures.
Okay.
Just briefly. They were up 20 to 30%, but do you know how they work?
No, I have no idea.
If the price goes down and sets a certain limit, you sell. There's no questioning. There's no Alan Higgins or Sarah saying, maybe we shouldn't sell. Computer says sell, we'll sell. We'll cover those a different time because I think it's a very interesting industry, which I have invested in before. But that was virtually the only area of joy. A few macro funds and the CTAs.
Yeah.
But your hedge funds. And linking to that is the 25-year anniversary of the demise of another amazing hedge fund.
I was going to say, yeah, it's the 25th anniversary of the collapse of long-term capital management.
So all of this is linked in because after that, so there's a bailout of that, long-term capital management. What did they do? Ultra-leveraged relative value.
Yes. They did something called convergence trading, is that right?
That's that sort of thing. One way of thinking about it, you've got two 30-year bonds. Mm. One is popular, one is less popular. The less popular one, you have a higher return on. Mm. Sell the popular one, own the less popular one. In theory, no matter what happens to 30-year treasuries, you're fine. Mm. But of course, what happens if it moves against you more and more and more and you're leveraged and the banks say, I want my money back? But anyway, just on that, Greenspan and the Fed cut rates.
Yes.
Which helped that 820% boom in stocks. So, so it's a big story, but yes, we can cover it. But finishing on the differences and comparisons.
Yes.
Yeah. So I've mentioned that.
You talked about bonds. So we're saying that bond yields are not going up in the way that they were.
No warning signal from bonds.
Yeah. Markets, we're saying, are. Well, there wasn't a sort of a bubble at that time, was there, essentially?
Not in equity markets. Not in equities conventionally. Not conventionally. Some people may argue under the surface there was signs of it, you know, extreme positioning and speculation, you know, maybe. But in terms of conventional valuations, no.
What about the housing market? Are there any similarities?
No, because the housing market was strong. The US housing market was for the last five years running into it, compounded by 11%.
Mm-hmm.
That might not sound that high, but for the US, that's quite a hot housing market. And places like California, Nevada were much hotter. And that's, of course, where a lot of the subprime was. So, yes, the housing market, and we don't have that kind of housing market now. We don't have a very hot housing market. So I'm pretty sure it's not this playbook that Michael's looking at.
Okay.
He's looking more at echoes of 2000, 2003, and maybe even the 87 environment, right? And especially 2000, 2003. But as you mentioned before, that was just so much more extreme. So kind of finishing our you know, series, the worrying thing about 08, 09 is that you can have a big crash despite reasonable valuations of equities. One.
Yes.
What to look out for, high yield bonds, maybe. Mm. And maybe, just to be fair, one signal in the bond market, this inverted yield curve. We haven't talked about it for a while.
Which is still sticking around, isn't it? Hasn't gone anywhere
yet. That was present, 08, 09, as well. So there was an inverted yield curve. So there are some similarities. I ain't going to stake my reputation and say it's more like a 10% correction than a minus 50.
Mm.
And hopefully that brings our big corrections and the Michael Burry theme to an end, unless something dramatic happens in markets.
But we are definitely going to look at some other corrections as we get a week where there's not a huge amount going on. So I think, is it fair to say then, in summary, that, you know, reflecting back on Michael Burry's current short, we don't know how much skin he's got in that game. We don't know what he's looking at, and we don't know what he thinks is going to happen. You're saying then we don't think he's seeing a 30% crash. He might be seeing a 10% crash, and he's just made a strategic bet essentially on that happening rather than, you know, another global financial crisis.
Yeah, I would say he's looking for a bit more than minus 10. So minus 10s are very, very common. Yeah. Minus 20s are less so, and we've just covered the really big ones, which are very, you know, rare. But minus 20s you do get every 2 or 3 years. And maybe it's more that playbook he's looking at. You know, we don't know. We're speculating. I think the point by going through these three big crashes, I think the point is we can say is really it doesn't look as extreme. Certainly 87, 2000, 2003. And 08, 09, I think we should say, just on the banking side, probably worth covering again what's different. Sorry, because we should say that. Obviously, we saw some reasonable-sized US banks go under.
Yeah.
But very specific, lots of interest rate risk and not steady depositors. Whereas, of course, banking became systemic in 08, 09.
Yeah.
And then finally, banks have far more capital. Yeah. So these banks were able to be saved. You know,
we saw that with the sort of mini banking crisis in the spring of this year, didn't we? Where actually everything seemed to be, I mean, obviously we had a few casualties and some regional banks struggled, but otherwise, essentially, the US banking system sort of held up, didn't it?
Did. And I'm gonna steal a great comment from my colleague Monique. You know who you are. You know who you are, obviously.
She's been on the podcast.
It's a crisis in some banks. Not a crisis in all banks.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it very, very different. Whereas it was spreading like wildfire. I was working at Morgan Stanley, and after Lehman Brothers, people genuinely thought Morgan Stanley could be in trouble. If you look at Morgan Stanley today, it's an absolute powerhouse, diversified into wealth management. We both know wealth management is a great business, don't we? Absolutely huge in wealth management, so good fee income coming through. That's just one example. So we've probably missed a lot, but I think we're there, aren't we, Sarah?
I think we are. I think we've pretty much covered what you need to know, or what investors need to know, and what we can learn from previous crises, and perhaps just putting into perspective a little bit Michael Burry's big short, which has garnered a lot of attention in the media. Certainly when it came to light. Thank you very much, Alan. A reminder that the views expressed in this podcast are not intended to constitute investment advice, are accurate at the time of recording and are subject to change. Thank you very much, as I said, Alan, for joining me today. Don't forget to check out the podcast page, as always, on Coutts.com. And of course, please subscribe and please rate the podcast if you wherever you access us, Apple, Spotify, Google Podcasts. We'll be back next week with more Need to Know. Until then, bye for now.